Louisiana Eats is brought to you with support from Louisiana Fish Fry, a staple of Louisiana kitchens for over 40 years. Maker of batters, coatings, boils, tartar sauce, cocktail sauce, and more. Louisiana Fish Fry, because life needs Louisiana flavor. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Although South Louisiana does not provide the easiest growing conditions, when fueled by passion and obsession, it's amazing what can be done. On this week's show, we introduce you to some real alternative thinkers who are successfully cultivating the unusual and the exotic. We begin with a trip to the Tiki Farm Food Lab, just across the state line in Pearlington, Mississippi, where Chef Ernie Fondas grows exotic fruits and vegetables used in the dishes he serves at his Sui Generis restaurant in the New Orleans Bywater. With a passion for sustainability, Ernie uses every scrap of food to achieve a zero-waste model in his restaurant kitchen. Then, we head down to New Orleans' Lower Ninth Ward to meet bamboo guru Mark Sanders, founder of Ninth Ward Nursery. He tells us the story of turning his bamboo obsession into a business. Finally, get ready to see bamboo on your dinner plate. We chat with Kay Copadryer, author of the book Cooking with Bamboo, who shares how she came to make bamboo part of her family's diet and how you can do the same. We're going behind the bamboo curtain on this week's Louisiana Eats. The Latin phrase sui generis means from nothing or one of a kind. It's also the name of a restaurant in New Orleans' Bywater neighborhood. Offering a menu that changes weekly, Sui Generis uses seasonal ingredients while also using every scrap of food to achieve a zero-waste model in the kitchen. The chef behind this experimental restaurant is Ernie Fondas. His culinary team meets every Monday to assess what fresh, fermented, or dried goods remain from the weekend and begin discussing their next menu. In the front of the house is Ernie's partner in life and business, Adrian Bell. You'll often find her behind the bar combining peppers, spices, herbs, and fresh squeezed juices to create cocktails, syrups, and flavor infusions. But what makes Sui Generis truly one of a kind? It's where those ingredients come from. Sharing a love for travel, especially to the South Pacific, Ernie and Adrian were in Fiji when they met a Canadian couple with a farm there growing a variety of exotic plants. The experience was so impactful that on the flight home, they resolved to create their own farm. Soon, the industrious pair purchased a 5-acre tract in Pearlington, Mississippi, which they named the Tiki Farm. Louisiana Eats joined Ernie at the farm, which produces an array of exotic herbs, vegetables, fruit, and edible flowers to fuel Sui Generis's unusual menus.
So the SG Tiki Farm is located in Pearlington, Mississippi. It's about a 45-minute drive from New Orleans. It's shorter when the 90 bridge is not out. So we're close to the coast. The property that we got, it was built to be a marina. So it's right on the bayou, and the bayou connects to the Pearl River and the Gulf, so we have access. The Tiki Farm is about 5 acres, and about half of its land, half of its water, and everything has a view of the water because it completely encircles the water.
So beautiful and charming and peaceful.
Yeah, our goal is for it to feel like you're on vacation, just a 45-minute drive from New Orleans as soon as you get here.
So what is your restaurant background exactly, Ernie?
So if you go all the way back, both of my grandfathers had restaurants in Boston. So I, as a little bitty kid, I would follow my grandfathers around to the restaurants and watch them make soups and help them. My grandmother was a really great Greek home chef, and I learned Greek food from her. And then I grew up around some of the Brennan's children around Commander's Palace, because we lived on Coliseum Street, a half block from Commander's. And when I was about 11 or 12, that's when Paul Prudhomme was the chef at Commander's. And we would go through the kitchen to go play in the courtyard, and I would stop and see Paul cooking and be in awe. And Paul, I called him Uncle Paul, he would be like, do you want to see what I'm doing? I'm making a roux. I can show you how to make a roux. And he literally showed me some things in the kitchen at Commander's Palace when I was a kid, and I was totally hooked. So really, when you say, you know, why go into the restaurant business because it's so tough, for me, it's like, I can't not be in the restaurant business. It's sort of like a part of my soul, so I have to do it.
Was there any particular moment when the restaurant waste just really caught your attention and kept it?
I think when it really set in, I was working at a big restaurant in Boston that's known, I don't want to say the name necessarily, but it was known for churn and burn, you know, like 2,000 covers a meal. And literally, we would be throwing away gallons of food every shift. And I just thought it didn't make any sense. So the concept of our restaurant has always been changing menu, use what's in season and fresh, because it tastes better and it's better priced. You know, if you have Black Drum today, maybe the next freshest fish in 3 days when you run out of a small amount that you bought, then you buy Pompano or whatever else is in season. So to me, it just makes more sense. And it's really how cooking should be. And it allows everybody who works with me the chance to participate in our menu design process, which is really kind of an amazing thing with our restaurant.
How many seats are there in the restaurant? How many covers do you do on an average shift?
We have about really like 40 seats, and we do anywhere from 40 to 75 covers on average. So our volume's not huge, and that does help us to get a little more creative and interesting and rotate things. And we're able to incorporate anything we grow. So like if I have a pint of something, I can put it on the menu.
I see you get things composting, growing. Dear Lord, Ernie, take us on the tour.
Yeah, we've got a lot to cover. I think we'll start with the greenhouse, which is a pretty amazing place to start.
Great, let's go.
So basically, this is like walking into a tropical rainforest.
Oh, it is. Gosh, it's warm, yeah. And it just smells green and growing in here.
Yeah. So the greenhouse that we have here, it's about 14 feet tall and about 50 feet long by about 30 feet. So it's a big space, and we have trees in here and many other understory and tropical plants and bushes and fruits. Above you right now is a mango tree, and the mango tree you can see is in flower.
What else is in here that's rare and unusual? I don't recognize much of anything.
Basically, everything in here is rare and unusual. That's because that's what we do. We look for unusual ingredients for cooking. So right below you got some Everglades tomatoes. It's a perennial tomato. It's a really delicious. They're super tiny. These are a quarter the size of a grape tomato.
Wow.
Then we've got some Brazilian and Ecuadorian rainforest chili peppers growing. Two different types of strawberry trees. We have a strawberry tree and a strawberry fruit tree. So we get literally like 7 gallons of strawberry tree fruit. And it tastes like a cross between cotton candy and crunch berries, you know, from Captain Crunch.
Yeah. And what does it look like?
I think I can show you. I think we have some on the tree. Give that a try and tell me what you think
it
tastes like.
It kind of looks like a cranberry.
It does.
Oh my God, it's so good.
And so we actually made crunch berry ice cream, where we used Cap'n Crunch to make our ice cream custard base. And then we froze the strawberry fruit berries, which look and taste like crunch berries, and put them on top of the ice cream. And it was a really cool menu item.
Ernie, what are those yellow things hanging?
Those are star fruit. We've got a bunch. And actually, these are on the menu this week at the restaurant. We're doing them with hamachi, you know, yellowtail. And so it's going to be star fruit with hamachi with a pickled red onion gel and a baby carrot that I'm going to harvest today from the farm, and then a couple other sauces and some finished salt. Oh, and also it's going to be with a tepache persimmon sauce. And so the tepache we made because we used pineapples last week, and so since we're zero waste, if we use pineapples, then what I want to do is figure out how to use all of the parts of the pineapple. So we have pineapple skins, and you take pineapple skins and the cores, and you turn that into, you ferment that and turn it into tepache, which is a fermented probiotic beverage. So we're going to use that as the marinade for the hamachi.
Such thoughtful food. So much thought goes into this. Now, I know that one of the many titles that you carry is barrister, and I'm very curious, how have you gotten all this stuff in the country legally?
That's a very good question. So everything that we grow is actually legal. We don't get things that aren't, because things are protected. So these are all items that can be sold here, and we buy them from reputable sellers, you know? So you have to be really careful where you buy it and source it, and you don't want to have things that grow out of control. But, you know, quite frankly, I like things that become a little bit invasive, because then I have more to eat. So everything that we plant out here, we plant on raised beds or mounds. So this is called a hugelkultur mound, which is a really cool technique where you start by layering big tree branches and logs, and then smaller branches and leaves, and you build up your mound in the same way that the forest floor grows. Because, you know, in the forest floor, the leaves and the branches fall down and compost and in place, and that's what makes the really beautiful springy soil that you find in forests. So we recreate it on the small scale in each of our mounds, and the reason we do that is because the ground here is very hard, heavy clay, and so the plants, their roots can penetrate the clay, and the clay has great nutrients, but if you dig in the clay and then try to plant something, you create a bowl and it rots out the roots. So that's why we do everything on mounds.
Is this something that you knew coming into the property, or is it something you've learned through trial and error?
So trial and error. I mean, trial and error is sort of my middle name. Experimentation is what it's all about, both in the restaurant with our weekly changing menu and out here with the, you know, the agriculture. Because Adrian and I were complete novices 6 years ago when we bought the farm, and we've learned over time. I mean, you know, there's a lot of information on the internet and books, so we research constantly and experiment. And, you know, the first thing you learn in farming is every site is different. And so in this site, things might work or might not work that would or wouldn't work somewhere else. So it takes time to learn your site, and then you can kind of grow from there, literally.
Growing in Louisiana is one of the greatest challenges in the universe because of the climate, because of the bugs that we coexist with. You couldn't have given yourself a more difficult place to do this in.
Yeah, it's true. There are challenges, but then there are solutions to a lot of those challenges. So it's, you have to learn, like I said, learn your site, and then learn what to grow when and how much. So for example, squash is really hard to grow in the New Orleans area, like basically south of Baton Rouge. When you get north of Baton Rouge, it's fine because it's not quite as humid, it's not quite as hot. Mm. But down here, you get that like sooty mildew on them, and they die. So if you want to grow squash, you got to start them in February. The summers are very difficult to grow, like salad greens, for example. So you mentioned that I'm an attorney, that's true. And so what I'm really good at is research, so I'm able to find unusual things that can grow here. And I've done a ton of research about salad greens. So I have a whole summer salad green program that we use. And a bunch of them are right over here, like katuk, moringa, the cranberry hibiscus. There's several types of spinach, like longevity spinach. There's some really great summer salad greens that grow right through the summer here. So we're able to supply our restaurant completely through the summer with salad greens, whereas nobody else in New Orleans pretty much can do that.
Amazing. No side degree in horticulture or botany?
No, I try to work with people that know what they're doing, and, you know, we just learn as we go, and some things work and some things don't work.
Coming up next, we continue our tour of the Tiki Farm with Ernie Fondas. He takes us into the Tiki Food Lab, where he and his partner, Adrian Bell, explore the science of flavor. In the meantime, here's music that incorporates Sounds of the Farm by Pink Teddy Bear, the farm's house band. That's right, the Tiki Farm has a house band. We'll learn more when Louisiana Eats returns after a short break. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Crystal Hot Sauce, creators of local hot sauce for more than 100 years. Always made with just 3 simple ingredients: aged red cayenne peppers, distilled white vinegar, and salt. Nothing artificial. Crystal Hot Sauce, a New Orleans tradition since 1923. From Louisiana Fish Fry, now doing for chicken what they've always done for fish. Fried chicken tenders, wings, sandwiches, and more. Louisiana Fish Fry offers a mix specially blended for chicken. Louisiana Fish Fry, because life needs Louisiana flavor. And from Rouse's Markets, synonymous with seafood straight from Louisiana's waterways. Rouse's Markets, homegrown and family owned for 65 years. If you're just joining us, we've been taking a tour of the Tiki Farm in Pearlington, Mississippi. This 5-acre tract is where Chef Ernie Fondas grows the exotic fruits and vegetables used in the dishes he serves at Sui Generis Restaurant in New Orleans. Next, Ernie took us up a flight of stairs to the Tiki Food Lab, where we met his partner, Adrian Bell.
The food lab is raised up because, you know, everything you build in this region has to be 16 feet above sea level. We built this 20 feet above sea level to make sure that we're fine. Basically, we're an entertainment center, learning center, and catering event space. So we do chef tasting dinners, food experiences that include farm tours, a tasting menu, and a class. And then the tasting menu is based around whatever the class topic is.
Oh, the view is so beautiful from up here.
Yeah, so this welcome to the food lab. And Adrienne's in here right now. She's always wanted to meet you.
Well, hi, Adrienne.
We're about 20 feet above the water, and you get this full view of the water, and the dining area is a bar where everybody faces the water. And we have a giant 20-foot garage door that opens, and so it's all indoor-outdoor, where the cooking happens right in front of the guests. And we've got sort of almost like a sushi bar setup where people sit right at the tables where we prep the food. Uh-huh. So you can choose your seating where you either watch us plate everything up and cook everything, or you're out front viewing the bayou.
The food lab is where Ernie and Adrian's explorations into the science of flavor goes into overdrive. Lining the lab's counter are one-of-a-kind experiments, from ancient Japanese koji fermented miso to garum, something that was popular in ancient Rome.
Part of how we use fermentation is to achieve part of our zero-waste cooking model. So one week we had some scallops that were left over, and I decided to turn it into a fish sauce by using koji. And it's a little funky, but...
It's beautiful. And you know, I can pick up the distinct scent of the scallop.
Right. Usually a fish sauce is just salty and kind of fishy, funky umami. Yeah. But this is actually purely scallop fish flavor, and it's really amazing. It's a strong flavor, so you would just literally use like a teaspoon when you're making a sauce, for example.
It's just delicious though, Ernie. So many delicious flavors.
This is a miso that we made with the strawberry fruit that you tried in the greenhouse. So now that's it fermented as a miso.
Oh my goodness, it smells to me like chocolate.
Yeah. Yeah, miso has a reference to chocolate in a lot of ways. And I made miso with cacao beans too. The cacao bean miso tastes like mole in a crazy way. So then I made a miso mole out of the chocolate miso that I made, which is really interesting.
Thank God you have a restaurant, Ernie, because I don't know where all of this creativity would go if you didn't have a place to display it like that. I mean, it seems to me that you and Adrian pull off whatever it is you set your minds to do.
You know, I'm able to balance it because you have to have good people that work with you. So I try to hire the best people, people with talent, people with passion, and, you know, with guidance, you can accomplish a lot of things by surrounding yourself with great people. So I'm lucky, Adrian and I are lucky that we've been able to work with many, many talented chefs, farmers, and people that are part of the community. And now Carlos, who's our music director, because we even have a music label.
Now, where does this music label thing come in? That really surprises me.
So Carlos Grasso, he's our music director for the music label, and it's called Sui Generis Music. One day, I was playing records at our restaurant. We have a little DJ booth, so we play records. And Carlos came in, and he asked me if he could DJ sometime, and I said, sure. So he started DJing. He was doing brunch, and he called it, it was something like Brunch with Monsters.
He would like bring in all sorts of things. Like he like had a tray of wine glasses with different amounts of water in. He also had a theremin.
And then I brought him out to the farm for a barbecue, and he was like, oh my God, can I do some recordings out here? So he did some recordings out of the farm, and you know, there's really great nature sounds. And he started experimenting with some exotica sounds and songs. And then, of course, our farmer at the time and everybody that works in the restaurant pretty much is a musician or an actor. So we had several of the people from the restaurant that joined Carlos and the band to create Pink Teddy Bear, which is our Tiki Farm band. And then we had a music label so we could record the LP and release that, and then maybe some other local bands too. Luckily, I don't have to do anything on the day-to-day on that side, but it's just part of the whole Sui Generis, you know, sort of collaboration.
So what are you dreaming up next?
You know, the future, I think the immediate future is just to share some of the research and knowledge. So we're doing on our TikiFoodLab.com website, we have a food blog and we post our research. You know, doing the research now that we have the food lab is really what I'm excited about. So like one thing I've been looking at lately is I found an article about the effects of magnetism on fermentation, because the theory is that strong magnets can actually, the magnetic field accelerates fermentation and changes the flavors you get. So I want to do a series of ferments that are misos, same batch, but do one at the bottom of the lake, because then you get constant pressure and temperature, and then one under magnetic field and then one at ambient temperature, and then taste them every 3 months and see what the differences are, and then report the results on our website.
Oh, well, I'll be reading. I'll be looking for it. That's the wildest thing. Ernie, you are a crazy guy. I'm so glad I had this opportunity to meet you. Thank you. Thank you so much for having us here today.
Thank you so much, Poppy.
Yeah, appreciate it. Fabulous meeting you and having you at the farm. We hope to do it again.
That was Ernie Fondas and Adrian Bell speaking with us at the Tiki Farm in Pearlington, Mississippi, just 45 minutes from New Orleans on a bayou connecting to the Pearl River and the Gulf of Mexico. To learn more, visit TikiFoodLab.com. Now, here's another track to take us out from the farm's house band, Pink Teddy Bear, from their debut album, Welcome to the Tiki Farm. Mostly desolate stretch of the New Orleans Lower Ninth Ward neighborhood, there's a nursery with humble beginnings that has become the go-to source for all things bamboo in the Gulf South.
Mark!
Oh, hi!
My name's Mark Sanders. I'm the owner of Ninth Ward Nursery.
Mark Sanders founded Ninth Ward Nursery in 2015 with a capital investment of $100 worth of plants. Like the stalks of bamboo shooting 20 feet in the air and swaying across his tiny nursery, Mark's business is thriving.
I always say, you know, we don't run a t-shirt factory here. You know, these are living beings. And, you know, without getting too woo-woo, they deserve our respect. So if somebody buys a plant, I fully expect them to take care of it and to nurture it with the same kind of love that we do.
Mark is a man who knows his bamboo. He's editor of Bamboo Magazine, the official publication of the American Bamboo Society, and serves as a member of its board of directors. We joined Mark at his nursery for a little bamboo banter and to learn how he developed his passion for this versatile, fast-growing plant.
Mark, how did you get into this business in the first place? When did you become such a bamboo aficionado?
Well, I don't know if I would call myself an aficionado. I'm still learning so much, and this is such a work in progress. I'm humbled every day by things that I'm trying to do with bamboo. But to answer your question, it started in the summer of 2015, and I was living not very far from here. I was living in the Upper Ninth Ward, and there was a big two-story house behind mine that I did not want to see. And I knew that this non-invasive, also called clumping bamboo, existed, so I bought some, planted in the backyard, realized that I had way more than I needed, and so I thought, all right, well, I don't know what to do with this extra bamboo. I'm just going to sell it. And so I put some up for sale, and people purchased it pretty quickly, and I thought, oh, all right, well, I just made a little bit of money on this. Why don't I go and get a little more bamboo and maybe see if I can sell that? And at the time, I, like so many other people in my generation, had just extortionary, exorbitant student loan debt. I thought maybe this would be a fun way to help pay off some student loan debt. I started thinking of every sale as almost like this trick or almost like this game. It's like the game is to see how far I could make that initial $100 investment. I bought 10 plants for $100. I got a great deal on them. And so I call it flipping that $100. And so every time I would make a sale, I would just keep reinvesting that money and reinvesting and reinvesting. I started the nursery in my backyard. But what happened was, over time, because bamboo grows and because I started learning how to propagate it, I ended up with just a handful of pots of bamboo in my backyard, and that turned into dozens, and then that just kept getting larger and larger. So I just needed more space to grow the bamboo. So I purchased this property in 2015. My nursery started with, I think, 10 plants, and at this point, I think I have about 2,000.
How many different kinds of bamboos are you growing out here?
Well, the short answer is, at any given time, maybe 12 or 13. But the slightly longer answer is, I could be growing many more because there are well over 1,000 different species of bamboo out there in the world. However, the reason I only grow a handful is twofold. Number one, I don't have space to carry 1,000 different types of bamboo. And the second thing is that some bamboos are more appropriate for, I don't know, mountain climates, and some are more tropical. So I only carry those that are going to be best for our climate down here in South Louisiana. The nature of what we do here, which is non-invasive varieties of bamboo, mostly for people who don't want to see their neighbors. And I just want to stress that not all bamboo is going to take over your yard, take over the world.
But, you know, so many people, like me myself, to be honest with you, I have always been so afraid to even think about planting bamboo because I have seen the bamboo takeover in backyards. Is it clumping and running? And what I'm scared of is the running bamboo, huh?
That's exactly what's a concern for a lot of people. Now, we grow bamboo that is called clumping bamboo. It grows in a cluster of shoots. And then when you plant it, over time, you won't be able to see your neighbors. Now, let's think about how many people are going to want that. Not every single person needs a 20-foot tall privacy screen in their yard. So as such, we are going to be one of very, very few nurseries that specialize in bamboo in this area. So if somebody wants bamboo, then they're going to be willing to come to the Lower Ninth Ward to get it. We don't need to be on St. Charles Avenue in order for people to come and find us. We need a little bit more space, and we like being out in nature here.
Now that I know the difference between clumping and running. Why don't you introduce me to your varieties of bamboo that you recommend people grow in our area?
So around the perimeter of the nursery, I have pretty much all of our different species of clumping bamboo growing, and I have no means or methods of containing it because we don't need to have that. But you can see all around, we have a clump, a clump, a clump, a clump, and we have yellow bamboos and green bamboos and some that are more blue in color. Probably our most popular one is called graceful bamboo over here. The graceful bamboo is this very traditional sort of idea of what people think when bamboo comes to mind. So really straight shoots, and it's just this very sort of electric green. So this is a species that we use around pools, in small backyards. That is probably the main one that we recommend. The others that we have are just kind of a matter of taste. Some people come in and they say, look, I saw this yellow bamboo on the internet or, you know, social media. I have to have that. Some get taller, some get shorter. We just try and have a little bit of a variety of different sizes here.
Well, I am so glad I finally got to come here because it's beautiful, it's charming, and the sound of the wind in the bamboo really thrills me, Mark.
So glad that you think so. It thrills me as well, Poppy. Thank you so much for coming.
That was Mark Sanders of Ninth Ward Nursery, a New Orleans-based garden center specializing in bamboo. Coming up next, we speak with Kay Copadryer, author of Cooking with Bamboo. Kay shares how she came to make bamboo part of her family's diet and how you can too. Louisiana Eats returns after the break. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Blue Plate Mayonnaise, made right here in Louisiana for over 95 years. And now, Blue Plate Hot and Spicy Mayo blends their only the egg yolks recipe with cayenne pepper heat. Blue Plate's Hot and Spicy Mayo in grocery stores everywhere or online at blueplatemayo.com. And from Ralph's on the Park, announcing the return of their summer tradition, a light offering of three appetizers with a glass of wine, including more than a dozen choices with classics like shrimp scully, turtle soup, and crispy fried oysters with remoulade sauce. Now through September 14th, Ralph's on the Park, dinner nightly, lunch Wednesday through Friday, and serving brunch on Saturday and Sunday.
My name is Kay Copadryer, and I've written the book Cooking with Bamboo.
Cookbook author Kay Copadryer's interest in cooking with bamboo did not spring from her own cultural background, but rather from the fact that her husband made his living crafting archery bows. His job led Kay from teaching religion and culture as a university professor in Canada to living on a bamboo farm in the state of Georgia. Still an academic at heart, Kay began researching the history and use of bamboo as a food source. The result was Cooking with Bamboo, a book filled with recipes using both fresh and canned bamboo shoots, along with instructions for making bamboo rice and even bamboo tea. There's also a fascinating history of bamboo in the United States, along with directions on how to harvest and prepare fresh bamboo for cooking, how to use bamboo leaves, and cooking in bamboo poles. Kay joined us for a conversation that may get you thinking outside the stalks.
The reason I got interested in bamboo is because my husband is a bow maker. And when I say bow maker, I mean bow and arrow. And a long time ago, he began working with bamboo. And then as a good Dutchman, he said, I need to secure my supplies. I was a university professor. We were living in Canada. He comes home one day and says, honey, I bought a farm. We're going to grow bamboo. We're going to do it in Georgia. And it's like, okay. And so at that point, it was like, I'd better love this plant. If I don't love this plant, well, at least I love the man, so I better love the plant as well.
So that was your bold introduction to bamboo. There you are in Georgia, surrounded by it. I guess you may as well eat it, huh?
Well, we actually weren't surrounded by it. So we had a parcel of land where sugarcane had been growing. And my dear sweet husband then set about planting bamboo. And we ended up with, we've probably got, I'm going to say maybe 32 different species, different varieties. Because once you fall into the rabbit hole of bamboo, it's like you're never going to get out. You're just going to be there forever. And at that point, it was like, bamboo is interesting. I enjoy working with it. And the question is, what else can you do with it? And that led to the question of, well, we can cook with bamboo. We can eat bamboo. And so cooking and eating bamboo led me to also want to write a book that introduces people to from ground up. You can eat bamboo shoots, but you can also harvest bamboo. And you also need to know what a bamboo shoot is. So all of those questions are questions I answer in the book.
With great little pictures, too, to illustrate. Kay, tell us what you know about cooking with bamboo, eating bamboo in America. There's a very interesting history behind that, isn't there?
I was fascinated when I started looking at, okay, recipe books, I look at, you read them like a novel. And so there's got to be a story behind everything that you eat. And so I started looking at how in America has bamboo been eaten. And that led me to interesting experiments at the turn of the 20th century, where there were plant explorers who wanted to revolutionize American agriculture, introduce new crops, expand the range of American agriculture, and among other things, introduce bamboo as a useful crop. And as a useful crop, it was for poles, it was for products, a nascent pulp and paper industry. But also, there was a great interest in introducing bamboo for culinary purposes. So there were characters like David Fairchild, who writes a book in 1902, which is Japanese bamboo and extols the virtues of eating bamboo. There's a Louisiana connection with the McElhenry family, E.A. McElhenry, who is the son of the founder of the Tabasco Company, who was an explorer, an anthropologist, and got very interested in another crop in addition to Tabasco, but the crop where you could plant bamboo, cultivate and can bamboo shoots, and get these bamboo shoots onto American lunch plates. At the same time, there's this very interesting, what I call chop suey craze going on. Now, chop suey, it's not really an Asian dish. It was invented in America. It's a mixture of vegetables that was a reasonable price, sold in little cafes, often run by Chinese immigrants. And it took off in America. So you find cookbooks, 1920, North Dakota, woman's like farmer extension bureau, and they're extolling chop suey. These recipes sometimes include bamboo shoots. They also sometimes don't include bamboo shoots. But it's like everybody in America was off cooking chop suey, sometimes buying canned bamboo shoots, and also just very interested in eating at restaurants where you could eat chop suey. The question of canned bamboo shoots in 1922, partnership of a Korean man and a man out of Michigan led to the founding of the company La Choy. And La Choy, we still find bamboo shoots, canned bamboo shoots in grocery stores everywhere. Well, La Choy, 1922, they began starting with making bean sprouts. The Korean man is growing bean sprouts, sprouting azuchi beans in his bathtub and canning those. And that led to now this great industry of La Choy, the introduction of Chinese food on ordinary grocery stores in America.
That is such a crazy story. I hadn't heard about the bean sprouts in the bathtub. My goodness, the roaring 20s were something. I didn't know you had bean sprouts and gin in the bathtub.
In the bathtub, exactly, exactly. And folks looking at, let's get dressed up and let's have some chop suey.
To your knowledge, is there much of a bamboo growing existence in America? Is there a lot of agriculture around bamboo today?
There are acres of bamboo being grown, but in comparison with pine trees, not so much, a tiny amount. But there's an interest in establishing an industry utilizing bamboo instead of pine trees for things like toilet paper. On one side, there's bamboo growers who are talking about cultivating, planting, growing thousands and thousands and thousands of acres. On the other side, there's an interest in the industry utilizing bamboo because it's sustainable, its environmental footprint is less severe than that of growing pine trees for the pulp and paper industry. But in the middle, the infrastructure, the actual development of the machinery, the harvesting, the processing, that is lagging behind.
Well, the plant itself is so versatile because it's not just the shoots. In cooking, the leaves are used sometimes too, huh?
That's right. It was funny. When I started thinking about cooking with bamboo, the obvious was bamboo shoots. So that was the obvious. And the bulk of the cookbook deals with bamboo shoots. But then I said, what else? How else is bamboo being used? And it was like, whoa, one of my favorite little snack foods. If you go to Dim Sum, you have these darling little dumplings. Then how many times have I unwrapped them, opened them up? I never noticed they're wrapped with bamboo leaves. It was like zongi. And so for those recipes, I went to a couple of friends of mine who are of Chinese descent. And I said, can you provide me recipes? And in one case, May not only provided me a recipe, but gave me a picture of her grandma, who is the person she learned to make zongi from.
Oh, gosh. Well, Kay, for people at home, a lot of folks might have a little bamboo in the neighborhood, how do you know if your bamboo is edible or not?
The answer is, as to the best of my knowledge, so I want to be cautious, to the best of my knowledge, all of the bamboo that is grown in America can be edible. The catch is that there are certain species which are a little bit more bitter. And the species I'm most familiar with are the running bamboo, the varieties of bamboo that just spreads. You turn your back and poof, it's up everywhere. That bamboo, the variety Mozo, Henan, Vivax, Madake, those are very edible. And the issue is that some species of bamboo do carry cyanide, but the cyanide that's carried will be rendered harmless once the bamboo shoots are subject to heat. And so we parboil all of the bamboo shoots. So you get them out of the ground, you take the sheaths off, you clean them up, and then you either cut them or in whole or bigger chunks, put them in a water bath, bring it up to a boil, let it simmer for a while, and that very act of parboiling will render the bamboo quite edible and quite ready to be used for whatever recipes you want.
Kay, what's your favorite way to eat bamboo?
I think of it's like a vegetable that's available only at a certain time of the year. And so you pull it out of the ground and it's like life and full of like vibrancy and vitality, because everything in the bamboo plant, the shoot, everything, like the whole comb is just in that shoot. You get it out of the ground, you clean it, you parboil it, and then you cook it with delicious vegetables. My favorite way is really the simple way. Maybe a vegetable stir fry, or a stir fry where you use chicken or something else. Bamboo shoots don't have a lot of flavor, but there's a subtleness and as I said, a vitality of it. So you want that kind of crunch. It's like, ah, this is new life.
Well, this has just been delightful. Thank you, Kay.
It was an absolute delight, and I hope everybody enjoys thinking about bamboo.
That was Kay Kopadryer, author of Cooking with Bamboo, which is available on eBay. You'll find a link on our website, poppytooker.com. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Catch up on previous editions of Louisiana Eats on poppytooker.com, where 15 years of Louisiana Eats is available for pod and webcasting, along with recipes and cooking class videos, too. And don't forget to rate us on your preferred podcast platform. Major support for Louisiana Eats comes from Blue Plate Mayonnaise, adding local flavor to poor boys, potato salads, and remoulade for over 95 years. Blue Plate Mayo, in grocery stores everywhere, or online at blueplatemayo.com. The Audubon Clubhouse, from Dickie Brennan and Company, a newly renovated and expanded Audubon Park property, adds a bar and private event space to the dining room and expansive wraparound porch. Serving weekday lunch, weekend brunch, and dinner Monday through Thursday till 9 p.m. And from the Ralph Brennan Restaurant Group, including Brennan's, the Napoleon House, the Redfish Grill, Ralph's on the Park, and Cafe Noma. Louisiana Eats is also made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Louisiana Fish Fry, Crystal Hot Sauce, Rouse's Markets, and Camellia Beans. Camellia Brand's Beans for Two includes Camellia's traditional beans and a seasoning packet of spices and vegetables that make dinner for two. Available for both red beans and white beans, in grocery stores everywhere or online at CamelliaBrand.com. And from D'Agostino Pasta, celebrating local culture with fleur-de-lis, crawfish, and alligator-shaped pastas, all handcrafted in Louisiana, just as it's been done in Sicily for centuries. In grocery stores everywhere or online at D'AgostinoPasta.com. Original theme music composed by David Pomerleau and performed by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to senior producer Joe Schreiner, producers Blake Longlinet and Becky Retz, and to our business manager and social media maven, Maddie Mulladew. Catch up with us anytime on Instagram and Facebook, too. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.